Babcock. How are you, sir?
What's up, my brother?
Just starting to be able to breathe correctly. I was in Vail this past weekend.
Do you feel like you're sucking on a helium balloon for 3 days?
Dude, I come from a state that's a pancake. I mean, well, I shouldn't say I come from a state, but I live in a state that's a pancake. So
yeah,
when you go, hey, I got a couple of shots we could show you. So when I go up to these mountains here, you know, it's a little rough for me. You know, I think this is what I think of when I go to the mountains. I'm like, you know, that's what I feel like. I don't feel like this. So
Looking for Noah's Ark up on Everest or something.
Oh, man, it's brutal. I don't know if you've ever gone to any mountains at all, but it's takes a little bit.
Yeah, in altitude. But then again, you know, like you said, your elevation is, what, 300 feet above sea level?
I believe the highest point in Florida is 300 feet
above. So you guys just kind of like walk around with, you know, life vests on all the time.
We're not Louisiana, but yes. But I've been looking forward to this episode for quite some time. Yeah. I know you have.
Oh, yeah.
I know you have. I know
this is going to be a fun one tonight.
We were lucky enough that our previous guest and our friend Robert Bruzio made the introduction. And we've been waiting for this for a while. And we had some hiccups on everybody's end. And I knew it would happen eventually, but I couldn't wait for it to really get going. When we do have somebody like this on, we don't sit here and chat as long as we normally do. We bring them on because, you know, they want to talk to them, not us. So,
yeah, I mean, the appetizers run out in the green room after a while. So,
exactly. He's done eating. He wants to come out here. So let us introduce the a very, very established producer, Mr. Bill Chartoff. Bill, how are you, sir?
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, Tony. Again, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it. I know you're a busy man.
I'm not that busy. Not busy. You can pretend I live a busy life of the Hollywood producer, but the truth is I spent most of my morning cleaning up tree trimmings from my yard. let's not over-romanticize it.
Right.
Okay.
But thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting me, and thanks to Robert Bruzio for
suggesting. We've been looking forward to this.
It's a pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, anybody that is a Rocky fan and has followed the Rocky world of movies knows that Bill's dad, Mr. Robert Chartoff, produced Rocky, the Rocky movies, I should say, not just Rocky, but won the best picture for Rocky. And I guess, Bill, just to get right at it, I mean, you grew up around Rocky. I mean, Rocky was a day-to-day thing with you.
I grew up with my father working in the film business. I mean, originally he started as a personal manager.
Okay.
He had an uncle who worked in the Catskill Mountains. His name was Charlie Rapp. And Charlie had a pretty good gig going. He would book all the acts, all the singers, all the comedians for the Catskill Mountain resorts, and he also managed the actors, or rather the comedians and the musicians. So he booked his own talent into. So he had a great gig going.
Yeah, really.
And Charlie was known as the King of the Catskills. Charlie.
It's kind of like Dirty Dancing, right?
I was waiting to say that, Tony.
Exactly. It's that era. Danny Kravitz, and I mean, it has been documented in several wonderful feature films that period. Awesome. But he didn't really know my father that well. What happened was, is my father was very close with his sister.
Okay.
And my father would work during the summers to pay for his college education. His father was who I was named after, was a musician. He played bass with the New York Philharmonic, but he didn't make such a great living. And so my father, Bob, in order to pay for his college, would work as a waiter in the Catskill Mountains in the summers. And at one point, my father's aunt said to her brother, she said, "You know, your nephew Bob works up in the Catskills as a waiter, and why don't you go see him one day? You know, be a nice guy." And one day, my father was it was in between lunch and dinner, and he got a he was resting. All of the waiters would sleep in these kind of dormitories that they would have. And one of the guys came to him and said, "Hey, Bobby, your uncle's up in the coffee shop. He wants you to come up and see him." And so he went up, and Charlie was sitting in a booth. And my father walked up to the booth, and he said, "Charlie, I'm your nephew, Bob." And Charlie looked at him and said, "You look like crap. Sit down."
And so, how do you do?
My father, I know, right?
Sat down, and they chatted for a while. And Charlie said to him, "Listen, next summer, don't do this. Come and work for me." And so thereafter, he began working with Charlie, driving him around and learning the business, really, by, you know, being Charlie's right-hand man. And eventually, he started helping Charlie manage all the acts. And eventually, he graduated from law school and started studying law. But he really hated law. He'd only become a lawyer to mollify his mother and father, who you know, both of them were in utter dismay when he had dropped out of medical school. So he went to law school, and so he finished at Columbia Law School. He passed the bar. He started working as a lawyer, and he hated it. So he went back to work for Charlie. And that's really how he got into the entertainment business and how he met Irwin Winkler, his eventual partner.
Okay.
Wow.
He worked for Charlie, managing people like, you know, I mean, just all the great comedians and singers. And eventually he convinced Irwin Irwin was working at the William Morris Agency.
Okay.
And he convinced Irwin to come in as a partner with him. And the two of them started managing different acts. They managed, people like Joni Mitchell, mm-hmm. and Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of the great musicians of the time.
Wow.
And also many of the wonderful comedians back then. And that's really how he got into the entertainment business. And that it was around that time that I was born, and we were living in New York. And eventually he and Irwin got an opportunity to make a film, if you want, I can tell you the story. It's
of course.
They were managing Julie Christie was one of their clients. And they got a call one day. That's my dog barking. They got a call one day from the head of production at MGM. And Julie Christie was at that time. She was, I think, starring in it was either Darling or Dr. Zhivago.
Okay.
And he said to them, "Listen, guys, we'd like your client Julie to be in our next film. Do you think that you could arrange it?" And they said, "Sure." And she was shooting in Europe, so they flew to Europe, and they convinced her to do the film. And they came back to New York, and they told the head of production that she had agreed to do the film, and he was very, very pleased about this. And he asked them to come in, and they met him, and he said to them, "Guys, if you ever have an idea for a movie, let me know." So 2 days later, they called him up and they said, "Listen, we got an idea for a movie." and they sent him a script on Friday, and they said to him specifically, they said, because they knew they could get her, they said, "We think that this would be a great, great film for Julie Christie." And she was a big star at the time.
Yeah.
He said, "Great, I'll read it over the weekend." He took it home and he called them on Monday and he said, so boys, I read your script over the weekend and I think it's a good script, but it doesn't feel right for Julie Christie. And they were immediately disappointed. He said, but I have another idea. And they said, sure, what's the idea? And he said, Elvis Presley. And Elvis Presley was even bigger than Julie Christie.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And so that was the first film that Bob and Irwin were involved in. It was a film called Double Trouble with
Double Trouble.
With Elvis Presley. And that really started their film careers. They made that film, and not long after they put together another film, which was called Point Blank with Lee Marvin. Mm-hmm. And it was an action film. Mm-hmm. And it's considered something of a classic, and it was very successful. And from that point on, their careers as movie producers really took off, and they just made one film after the other.
Wow.
Wow. That's,
and yeah. So they were very, very fortunate. I mean, as my father said, you know, it's very different than today. Back then, one guy could greenlight a movie. They knew the head of production.
Mm-hmm.
He liked them.
Yeah.
And if he said the film was a go, it was a go. Whereas today it's much more corporate and
sure.
A lot more, you know, a lot more people are involved in these decisions. But back then, things were streamlined and they could get things done.
Sure. Back then they even had handshake deals. I mean, there was a different world back then.
That's right. World. That's right. I mean, another wonderful story my father told me about getting Point Blank made was that they became familiar with a director named John Borman, who made Deliverance and many other great films, and turned out to be one of my father's great friends for much of his life. They became very, very close, and John is a wonderful director. But he wasn't well known then. He had only made one film called Hell in the Pacific. And it was with Lee Marvin. And so they went in, they were a little worried that MGM would not approve John as the director. So they went in to a meeting, and it was the head of production, and he had all his henchmen sitting on the side. And the head of production said to him, so, you know, we read Point Blank. It's a good script. Who's gonna play the lead in this movie? And they said, well, we've managed to secure Lee Marvin. And he said, ah, Lee Marvin. Wow. Fantastic. Love Lee Marvin. Tough guy. Love him. Who's gonna play the girl in the movie? They said, well, we've got Angie Dickinson to star as the, he said, wow, Angie Dickinson, Lee Marvin. Wow, what a couple. Oh, this is fantastic. And he said, this sounds great. Sounds like we're going to make this movie. One other question. Who's going to direct this movie?
Oh, no.
This was the question they'd been dreading. And just as he asked the question, the phone rang. And he said, 1 minute, guys, 1 minute. And he picked up the phone. And there was a problem on one of his productions. And they all sat there in the room for about 15 minutes while he dealt with the problem. He hung up the phone. And he said, Point Blank, Lee Marvin, Angie Dickinson. Okay, let's make this movie.
That's awesome.
Completely forgot to ask about the director.
God, that's so funny.
Yeah. Saved by the Bell.
And, and so they made a series of films thereafter. They made a film. Let's see. They made They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Oh, yeah.
Which was an Oscar winner and a very successful film. They made a series of good films and also some really bad films.
Yeah.
Some of them worked, some of them didn't. But of course, it all changed when Rocky got made.
Oh, yeah.
And they had just signed, Bob and Irwin had just signed a deal with MGM United Artists. It was a first look deal, and it was one of the first look deals that any producers had at the time. And basically what that meant is that any film that they wanted to make, they had to bring it to MGM first.
Okay.
And if MGM wanted to make it, they had the first right to make it. And they promised to make two films a year from Charlotte Winkler. Okay. And actually the first script that they brought them was Rocky. Which as you know, as Hollywood lore,
yeah,
you know, that they were not that enthusiastic about it.
Yeah.
Right.
They didn't know who Sylvester Stallone was. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like you know, it wasn't really what they were expecting to get out of them. But Bob and Irwin were very very enthusiastic about it, and they pushed them hard to make it. And there's a very good story that I don't know if anyone is on this podcast has talked about this story, but even Sly has confirmed it to me, that you know, back then United Artists were all back in New York.
Okay.
And you know, the MGM, they're two companies, MGM UA, and they ran sort of autonomously. United Artists had come up, it was a creation of Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford.
Oh.
Originally, that's how the company had begun. And the idea behind United Artists was that you would let the artists make the movie. You wouldn't interfere, you wouldn't get in their way, you would leave them to do their work once you had agreed to make it. So they had proposed this to UA. UA was not, as I said, was not so enthusiastic about it. But they, you know, Bob and Irwin sent them a film called The Lords of Flatbush.
Oh, yeah.
Which Sly was in. And Sly had a leading, he wasn't the lead in it, but he had a big role in the film.
Yep.
And so they wanted to know who Sylvester Stallone was. So they sent a print back then, you know, nothing was digital. They sent a gigantic print back to New York for them. And all the guys from UA got together in the screening room and they sit down and they start screening The Lords of Flatbush. And the lead of the film was a guy named Perry King.
Perry King, yeah.
And Perry King's a good-looking, blonde-haired guy. And so they start watching the movie, and at some point, one of the heads of UA shouts out, "Which one is Stallone?" And Perry King was on the screen, and somebody said, "It must be him." And then another voice said, "That can't be Stallone. Stallone's an Italian name. This guy's got blonde hair and blue eyes." And then another voice said, "Maybe he's Northern Italian."
Well, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they really liked Perry King a lot in the film.
Oh, geez.
They agreed to make Rocky with Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, man.
And so, but as you know, they agreed to make the film. They agreed to put in no more than $1 million for the film. And they told Bob and Irwin that if they went over at all, that they were responsible for what any overages on the film. And here, I'm just moving because the light is a little bit funny.
No, you're good. You're fine.
Yeah. But so they went off and they made the film and they put together an edit. And they sent it back to New York. And of course, it, being United Artists, nobody bothered them. Nobody came to the set. Nobody, you know, there was no interference. And so all the guys from UA got together to see the first cut of Rocky in the UA screening room in New York. And they sat down. And this was a kind of a rough cut of the film. And they start watching it. And Sly comes on, and the movie's 1 minute in, 2 minutes in, 5 minutes in. And at some point, one of them says, "Where's Stallone?" So But they watched the film and they loved it.
Yeah.
And the film had cost $1.2 million or something like that. And so Bob and Irwin were on the hook for $200,000, which $200,000. Was back then was money.
Oh, yeah.
And it is too, but back then it was really money.
I remember hearing the rumors or it might have been just the fact that your dad and Irwin, they had to like put up their houses.
It's correct.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true. They had put up their houses as collateral for any overages.
Right, right.
And so they get a phone call after they watched it from the head of UA. His name was Arthur Krim. And he said to them, listen, guys, we watched Rocky. And the first thing I'll tell you is, you know that $200,000 that you went over on the film? He said, don't worry about it. Then he said, I predict that Rocky will make $10 million at the box office.
Damn.
We think it's great. We love it. And I think it's going to be an absolute smash and make $100 million at the box office.
Wow.
And of course, when it came out, it made $100 million. $100 million were theirs about in its initial box office release. So that's really, what got them started on Rocky. It all went on from there.
Sure.
There are a couple of things that you might look for next time you watch the film.
Okay.
If you remember, there's a scene where Rocky is called into the manager's office. Mm-hmm. He doesn't realize it. He thinks he's coming in to be a sparring partner.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
But the idea is that, that they actually want him to fight Apollo Creed.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes in and he walks into the office and he walks up to there's a secretary there. And sitting on the secretary's desk is a photograph of a boy with a sailor's hat on, like a captain's hat on. And that's actually me.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
There's a scene in the film where he's walking down the street in Philadelphia late at night. He passes two kids on the street and they go, hey, Rock, you're Rocky.
Yeah, yeah.
To him. And that's not my sister and I, but it's our voices.
Oh, really?
They were doing the ADR and they needed the voices of the two kids. And we were there with my father.
Yeah.
So we recorded, my sister and I recorded the voices. Hey, Rock, you're Rocky. And so we're forever memorialized in
exactly
those two scenes in the film.
That's awesome.
And another story. I'm not giving you guys any chance to talk, and I hope it's
There's a reason why this is happening. Nobody wants to hear us talk. Trust me. We want to hear your stories.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get around this sunlight, but here, let's see if that's any better.
I wanted to know what that boxing picture was on your wall.
Well, this is actually I got a couple of things. This thing back here is actually a really cool Rocky poster.
I've seen, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen this one. It was from a screening they did in 2010.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's got the steps.
On the steps in Philly. I
love that, yeah.
Yeah. And here's a poster from Point Blank.
Okay.
Nice. I love the 70s posters.
Yeah.
So
this is just a photo from Raging Bull.
Okay. Raging Bull. I couldn't really see it, but I was interested in it.
Wow.
So, you know,
we want to hear all the Rocky stories you have, Bill.
Another one I'll tell you is the first time I saw the film was with it was my my younger sister and I. We went with my father and John Avildsen. I was, I guess, about 13.
Okay.
My younger sister was probably 11 or 12. And we went down into the screening room at MGM, which was in the basement. They had some screening rooms. And so we went down there and it was just the four of us watching the movie. And that was the first time I saw it. And I remember we really enjoyed it. And, we were with, Bob and John Avildsen after we were done, we stayed in the screening room and Bob and John started talking about, apparently they were contemplating cutting out the scene with Little Marie. The feeling was that it didn't advance the plot in any way. And I guess they were looking to shorten the film a little bit. And I remember that my sister and I said to them, you cannot cut out that scene. That makes you love Rocky.
Yep.
Feel compassion and sympathy for him. Mm-hmm. And wow. And we do not, and my sister and I both talked them into not cutting out that scene.
Well, I mean, you guys were right. Like, you're absolutely right. It doesn't further the plot line. It doesn't take anything away from the plot, but it develops Rocky into, yes, you like him. He's not a thug. He cares.
He's a well-meaning guy.
Yeah.
And you really, you feel such compassion for him because he tries to do a good deed, a good thing. And it shows that he's got morals and ethics. Mm-hmm. And even if he is, you know, kind of a loser, so to speak, as he would call himself at that point. Yeah. But he tries to do a good thing and then he gets rebuffed.
Yeah.
You know, for trying to do something nice. And it makes you kind of feel even more compassion for him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a key scene, I think, in the film, and I'm so glad that they kept it. I mean, the key scene, in my opinion, in that movie is that scene after he goes to wander around the spectrum the night before the fight. Mm-hmm. And he comes back and he's sitting on the bed and and he says to Adrian, I can't do it. I can't beat him. What he says,
rumor has it, I'm sorry to interrupt, Bill, but rumor has it that they were trying to cut that as well. I've read that before, that they were trying. I
never heard that. It would have been very hard to cut that scene because what he says is so vital, which is that it doesn't matter if I win or lose. What matters is if I'm standing at the end after 15 rounds. It doesn't matter if I get my head bashed in.
Yep.
But if I'm still standing after 15 rounds, I'll know I wasn't just some other bum from the neighborhood, I think, are the lines.
It sums it all up right there.
And that is such a key moment in the movie because he sets his own goals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Rocky does in all the sequels, you know? The goals are not ones that are set by people. He sets his own goals.
Right.
And that's so key to us appreciating, you know, we all relate to that, you know, that that we must decide what's important for us rather than taking it from the outside world.
Exactly.
We've said before is that all of the movies have such a life affirming, the messages that are portrayed through them. You know, you can't walk out without just feeling the adrenaline in every cell of your body and just wanting to be a better person, to try that much harder, to go a little bit further. Every one of those movies just, you know, they do it to you.
Yep.
You know, my father said in an interview he did, he was asked about boxing because, of course, you know, he also produced Raging Bull and all these boxing films. And he said, listen, I don't like boxing. I'm not a boxing fan. There it is. Yeah. Well, here are a couple of frames from the opening of the film.
Oh my God! Oh, wow. You remember these ones?
That I got.
That's awesome. You
can see them in there.
That's when that's when they're playing the music. That's the slow motion opening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, he said, I'm not a boxing fan. I don't even like boxing. My father said. He said, but what I like is a good story and good characters and characters that you can feel for. My father was a proponent. It's always been that in Hollywood that films get made because in many cases, just because they have big name actors in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the financiers can feel more secure that they'll make their money back because people want to see a movie with this big star, that big star.
Right.
And my father also, and I think it's part of why they in the end did push to get the movie done with Sly, who was unknown, because I think they recognized that he may not be a well-known guy, but he's a very talented actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the end, people don't go to see movies for big stars. They go to see them for good stories.
Exactly. I mean, there's been plenty of times where I've gone because of the big star. It wasn't a great story. It wasn't a great movie. It was okay. But the story or the characters, they grab you, you're in.
Yeah.
You're in, you know.
Yeah.
When you wound up doing Balboa 2006, was that almost like a, I guess I could say a bucket list item of yours that you wanted to produce a Rocky movie, you know, your dad and yourself?
Can I tell you one more story about Rocky?
Okay. You can tell me as many stories about Rocky as you want.
I don't know if anyone has told this story.
There's no tape length on this, Bill. I will get
to Balboa for sure. Have people talked about the ice skating scene on this podcast?
About how there was no extras and
that's
how
right.
They did it? Yeah, that's right.
So you know about that. Yeah. I mean, I always think that's another scene that really speaks to John Avildsen and his brilliance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how, in a way, the fact that they were under-resourced in making the film forced them to be creative.
Absolutely.
In the way that they did things. And that the movie came out so much better for it. The fact that they couldn't afford to pay extras meant that they had to figure their way out into that ice skating rink. And Rocky had to pull a little bit of a con job. And the only reason was because they couldn't afford all the extras.
Right, right.
I think it worked out better.
It worked out better.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
Well, the scene was more intimate. It wasn't, wasn't people skating by and a lot of crowds. It was more intimate. It was, she was able to talk. He's, you know, it was definitely much better.
Yeah.
It's unexpected. It's unexpected. It's not what you expect from the ice skating scene. And that brings us to Balboa, because in Balboa, of course, he goes back to the ice skating rink. And I think that this is the night that Robert Bruzio was there on the set.
Okay.
If I recall, probably the first time I met Robert, that we shot, we shot on an empty just an empty, in the middle of Philadelphia, this kind of empty lot. And that was theoretically where the ice skating rink had been many years ago. And Rocky talks about how he met Adrian there and how much he misses her and what, you know. So, producing a Rocky movie was not on my bucket list. What I would say is I worked, you know, I mean, I've been so fortunate to have, you know, my father was, number one, such a wonderful man, and a loving father, and just a, you know, a good guy, just a gentleman. So I was very fortunate to be born his son. But I started working on films early on his films, Raging Bull being the first one that I worked on when I was 16. And what happened really...
what did you do?
On Raging Bull?
Yeah.
Raging Bull, I was a production assistant. It was the first film I'd ever worked on. I was growing up in New York. Okay. It was the summer. We were shooting in New York. And I had no experience at all working on a film set. So I basically brought people coffee.
Okay.
I would bring the film to the lab at the end of the day.
Okay.
There are all kinds of things, you know, it was actually on television recently and I flipped it on and there's a scene where they're in Detroit and they're in a hotel room. And the fight has been delayed because of rain and, you know, Jake LaMotta is stalking around the hotel room and he gets in a fight with his wife and with his brother. And he's all anxious and nervous before the fight because it's been delayed and he just wants to get out there and fight. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but there are two guys, the doctor and the manager, I guess, practicing sewing up a.
I do remember that.
I ran out and found the stitching that scene. You know, we didn't have any of the, you know, the wire or the thread that they used. I remember I was watching that scene. I went somewhere in New York to find actual stitching.
Oh, that's awesome. So
you end up doing all kinds of odd things, you know, that. And then what happened is later, and I was at that point in high school, they were editing in New York. And so I would go to high school during the day, and in the afternoon, I would go to the editing room. And I was working in the editing room. It was the first editing room I worked on. I worked on several after that. Scorsese and Thelma Shoemaker were working out of Scorsese's apartment, but we had a separate editing room where we would keep, all the film, and we would reconstitute it and have it prepared for them to work at night. We would do that during the day, and they would work all night. They did sort of a night shift. And I remember that, back then we were working on film, of course. Nothing was digital. And so one of the things I would do is I would go to Scorsese's apartment and I would bring him all the stuff they needed to work on that night. And then I would bring the stuff back, the reels that they had worked on the night before, back to the editing room. And then I would reconstitute them. What that means is you would run them through a synchronizer and you would put fill. So you get movie footage that, just old, movie footage that you would buy by the pound to keep all of the reels in sync. Because sometimes they would take sound and sometimes they would take picture. At that point, the sound and the picture are separated into two.
Oh, that's right. Okay?
So if they take some of the picture, then they don't take the sound, then it's going to be out of sync, and you have to keep it in sync. So that if they want to work on it some more, it's in sync and they don't have to mess around with it. And one of the things I remember is that, we had a funny, a funny thing there that all of our, the fill that we would get, to fill in was all, this old porno, movie. So, on Friday nights, we would all have, and all the editors back then smoked like chimneys, And so we'd all sit around in the editing room, and we'd drink and we'd smoke and we'd watch the porno films we had as film. So
that's hilarious.
And it was, I was so lucky because, Thelma Shoemaker and Sonia Polanski, and the people that worked there were always so kind to me and anxious to teach me. And it was just the best afternoon job anyone could have.
That's amazing.
I remember Jake LaMotta would come to the editing room on occasion, and we were under strict orders never to show him anything. Never. And so he would be trying to look at stuff and we would be hiding it from him. Yeah. And what a great first movie to work on. I was really lucky. I didn't know one movie from the other. I'd never worked on.
Could I ask a question?
No, sorry. No. Sorry, Rick. No questions.
Is it my turn?
Time's up, Rick.
Okay.
One of the more Rocky stories.
I know. Go ahead. Well, it's your show, man.
it's just since you're talking about the editing process.
Yeah.
And all the knowledge that you have about it. One of the questions that we had was, and we've discussed this at many lengths before, is when you're doing the movie and you edit and you cut out certain scenes because you feel maybe they don't advance or whatever the case may be, but like on Balboa, for example, or Creed 2, there were some deleted scenes on there in those movies that Tony and I have discussed. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that they were not actually included in the movie. How do you go about, if that's your job or somebody else's job, the process of saying, no, I don't think this is going to work, or it's just going to make it too long? In today's day and age of movies where they can go up to 4 hours long, does it matter that much?
Well, the film is almost always too long. On your first cut, it's almost always the case that you're going to have to lose some things, and it's painful to lose certain things, especially your babies, the wonderful scenes that they just, as I said, maybe they don't advance the plot, and you just have to, as they say, you know, kill your babies sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it on occasions. A lot of times what you do, not a lot of times, I mean, today, always what you do mm-hmm. is, you know, you get a cut of the film and then you show it to a small audience mm-hmm. and you ask them questions after, and you get a sense of what they're understanding, what they're not, what doing they're liking. Do they feel the film is too slow in places? Is it too, mm-hmm. does it move too fast in places? Are there areas where they feel it kind of loses momentum? Mm-hmm. So you throughout the editing process, you do a lot of small screenings okay. and you get feedback from audiences. Now, of course, you know, as filmmakers, you know, the director and the editors and also the producers are going to have some experience, hopefully, and they're going to have comments as well. And they're going to have beliefs of where they think things need to mm-hmm. To be taken out. And sometimes even that things need to be put back in. It's a process of trying things, seeing if they work, and if they work, great. And if they don't, trying something different. Mm-hmm. The editing process, it's an incredibly creative process. It's such a different experience than shooting the film. It's a very, very different process. And the film is, you know, it's really kind of smoothed out in the editing process. And that's where the film, of course, ultimately comes together. One scene that I still, you know, still breaks my heart that was cut out was there was a scene in Creed 2, a wonderful scene with Sly giving a eulogy for Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I remember talking to Sly after the scene, after we shot it. He was so brilliant in the scene.
Yeah.
So he was incredible. It was so moving. He was so brilliant. And ultimately, the scene had to get cut out. The film, we just had running length issues. Mm-hmm. But it broke my heart that the scene got cut out. But I understood why. But even to this day, it still pains me that he was so great in the scene. I can't tell you. I wish that everybody could have seen it.
The fight with Rocky and Drago in the hotel in the hospital lobby,
right?
You know, I'm that in Spider Rico's eulogy,
yeah.
And there were several others. I was just like, my jaw hit the ground. I'm like, oh my god, I can't. Yeah. You know,
it's
painful. I couldn't do that.
Sure, I'm sure it's tough.
It's painful, but in the end, you know, you have to sometimes. You know, as they say, you have to kill your babies for the benefit of the movie as a whole.
Right. I get it.
Very, very difficult and painful decisions, especially for the director and the writers.
Yeah.
Who and the actors who
sure
put their heart and soul into those moments.
Sure.
And they want people to see them, and so when they get cut out, it's really. But sometimes you have to do it for the good of the film as a whole.
Tony and I want to be a part of the panel that watches these movies. Going forward, just saying.
Just so you know.
You know, if you didn't have a podcast, we could consider it. But you're going to come in, you're going to come here and start blabbing about it.
So. Never, never. Let me tell you something. On a side note, I was an extra on Creed 2.
Were you?
I was. A couple of scenes where Adonis fought Baby Drago, Victor. Mm-hmm. And was knocked down, and then Victor hit him when he was on the ring on the canvas. As part of that scene, I played Barkley Security.
Uh-huh.
And then
Philadelphia, obviously.
Oh yeah, at Sunset.
That stage out there outside of Philly.
Right, Sunset.
Yeah.
And then also at Adonis, the walk up scenes, Victor and Adonis in Russia.
Okay.
Me and my wife were there. Amazing moments we'll never, ever, ever forget, and that's where I got to meet Sly.
See now, Bill is immortalized in Rocky with his right. He's got you're immortalized in Creed 2. We got to do something about that.
I know, Tony.
Robert mentioned, I got him and his daughter. But unfortunately, that scene got cut out.
Oh, geez.
We came to Philly and, you know, Robert and I are good friends. And
that's right. He told us.
And I was really happy to get his daughter and he and, you know, into that, you know, as extras and that. And unfortunately, it got cut out.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of which, I noticed you were showing those photographs during the introduction of Sly in the mountains.
Yes.
And that's clearly from Rocky IV, of course.
Right here. This one, Russia.
Yeah. Yeah. That was actually in Jackson Hole. I was there.
You were there?
I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Yeah. And it was it was gorgeous up there. And I worked on Rocky IV. I worked as a location manager on Rocky IV.
Okay.
So you pretty much, I mean, you were involved in all the Rockies in some way.
Not all of them.
No, but you were.
I was around for a lot of them. Rocky IV was the first Rocky film I actually worked on.
Okay.
But I will tell you a story. I was going to a boarding school in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And they were, of course, and my father was in Philly shooting Rocky III. And I came for the weekend. I came to Philadelphia to spend the weekend with him when they were shooting. And I get there kind of Friday evening. And he says to me, "We're going out to dinner." I said, "Okay, who are we going out to dinner with?" Now, my father was very, very friendly with Burgess Meredith. They played Mickey. Burgess and my father were, my father was with Burgess maybe probably the day he passed away. And they were great friends. Burgess loved wine. He was a real wine connoisseur. So anyway, he said to me, "We're going out to dinner." This would have been Rocky III. "We're going out to dinner with Burgess and with Mr. T."
Oh, what a combination.
And he said, "Mr. T is one of the actors in the movie. You're going to meet him. We're going down to the lobby now. We're going to meet him and we're going to walk to the restaurant. And trust me, you won't forget him." And he told me a story about Mr. T, actually, I think before we met him, that Mr. T's real name is Lawrence. He said to me that my father was the only one who was allowed to call him Lawrence.
Oh my God.
And that the reason he made everybody call him Mr. T, because when he was a boy growing up, his father, I think he used to shine shoes, his father, and everybody used to refer to him as boy. They would say, "Hey boy, boy, clean my shoes, boy." And he said to himself, "When I grow up, nobody's going to call me boy."
Mm.
So that's why he named himself Mr. T.
Gotcha.
Is T for his last name?
I don't know his last name, actually. I just know that his first name is Lawrence. I never really, I mean, I guess you can Google it. I'm presuming it is. But so we go out to dinner together and where we start walking, and Philadelphia was a tough town back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to walk to the restaurant. We're going to a French restaurant. And we walk through some of the toughest neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And Mr. T looked just like he does in the movie. He had the mohawk and the feathered earring, and he's built like a, you know, like a truck. And it's these three white guys walking through these tough, dangerous neighborhoods in Philadelphia with Mr. T, and you never felt so safe.
Yeah,
a bad neighborhood. You know that you were with Mr. T. Nobody was going to mess with you.
No,
right?
And we went to this French restaurant, and I remember that Burgess was ordering all of these great bottles of French wine and giving us all a lesson in wine. My father, Mr. T, and I, a lesson in fine French wine. It was a wonderful evening. Very, very memorable. Awesome.
Well, just to circle back on that, I can tell you that Tony and I would never say a word if we were to pre-watch these movies.
You're still working on that, huh?
I am. You're not thinking about that. I am not right. giving it up.
All right, let's see what we can do for Creed 4.
Yeah, please.
I'm all in. I'll sign a non-disclosure. We're good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any stories from Rocky 2 since we skipped over that?
No, I didn't work on Rocky 2. The only thing I can tell you is that I remember, you know, I was just a kid. I guess when they made Rocky 2, I was, I don't know, 14 or something, 15, mm-hmm. maybe 14. And I remember that I was with my father and I overheard him talking about Rocky 2. And I said to him, "You're going to make Rocky 2?" He said, "Well, we're talking about it." And I said to him, "Don't do it."
Well, thankfully, this guy didn't listen to you.
Rocky was perfect. Everybody loved it.
Which is true.
Don't ruin it. Just leave what's well enough alone.
Yeah.
Wow.
You won an Oscar for it. You made good money on it. It will be remembered forever.
Forever.
Don't do it. Don't destroy it, I said to him. Thank God he didn't listen to me.
I'm going
to
say, yeah, that time, good thing he didn't. Is exactly yeah. right. And this was back when, before there was, everything had a sequel all the time.
That's right. Sequels were not so common back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were not so common back then. But obviously, you know, Rocky II turned out to be a wonderful film. And mm-hmm. and I guess that was my fear. I guess my fear was that it would all get destroyed if they didn't make a good movie, but
sure.
Fortunately they made me Rocky.
Well, you know, a lot of sequels Rocky never, II. A lot of sequels never,
yeah,
ever, you know.
Yes,
yeah, but I know there are a lot of people who like it, Rocky II as much, and some even more. I believe that Ryan Coogler told me that was his favorite Rocky.
Okay,
you know, it's funny. Yeah. I do remember reading that he used to watch that one with his dad.
I think Ryan told me that was his favorite mm-hmm. Rocky movie, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting.
It's funny mm-hmm. because Rocky used to be my favorite above all of them. I'm older than most of the people when we talk about them, we bring them on the show. I was 10 when Rocky came out. And when Balboa came out, I was 40 years old and I had a lot going on in my life. So the older I get, the more I relate to and understand Balboa more.
Absolutely.
Than the others.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing with Balboa was that, you know, Rocky V had been, you know, had not been a success.
Mm-hmm.
And it was critically panned. It was the first of the Rocky films that really didn't enjoy financial or critical success.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it really ate at Sly.
Yeah.
But one of the things I remember is that when we started working on the film and announced that we were doing it, all of the talk shows, you know, and then late night hosts, you know, they say, they've announced that you're doing Rocky Balboa. What's Rocky going to fight this time? Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah.
There were all kinds of jokes. Are they fighting in wheelchairs? People were making fun of us.
Yeah.
But they didn't know who they were dealing with. They didn't know they were dealing with Sly, who you know is you know an incredible workaholic. I don't know. I'm sure everybody has told you his work ethic is second to none. Really,
two of the best movie speeches, in my opinion, ever came out of that movie.
That's right.
One in front of the boxing commission, and one on the street corner.
One with his son. Yeah.
Boom.
One of the things to look for in the scene with his son. Is that I remember we shot so many of these movies all night in the winter in Philadelphia. It was not easy. A lot of these movies had a lot of night scenes and we would shoot all night in, you know, it would be 15 degrees out and snowing. And I remember that night we had a lot of problems because it was snowing when we shot one side mm-hmm. looking one way. And then when we turned around to shoot the other side, it stopped snowing and it was really havoc. But you know, what a great scene it turned out to be.
Yeah.
And of course, I think working to our benefit was that people's expectations after Rocky V were not so high. you know? And so when we actually delivered, you know, an exciting, moving, well put together, wonderfully written and directed movie by Sly and wonderfully acted by, you know, all these wonderful cast members.
Oh, yeah.
People went in with low expectation and they got something very different than what they expected.
Well, and considering it was 16 years later, you also got a lot of new people that really maybe even didn't know Rocky, didn't know the failure of Rocky V.
Right.
So, and it's a good testament to how a good story and a good character can make you love the movie.
Once again. Mm-hmm. Once again. And that character of Rocky is so infectious, whether he be 30 or 60 or 70. There's something about that character that, you know, and you know, it's amazing to see Sly. He just falls right into it, you know.
I'm sorry.
No worries. He just falls right into it, and he just knows how that people respond to that.
Sure.
And of course, I want to, of course, mention, you know, Burt Young and Carl Weathers, who we lost both of them recently. And Bert was like family to me. My father and he really loved each other. And Bert was such a kind man and such an interesting guy. And I, as Robert talked about him on the podcast you did with him, he was just such a joy to be around. Mm-hmm. Such a lovely, warm, you know. And I didn't know Carl quite as well, but I saw him on many occasions, and he was always very warm and kind and pleasant. He was just always a very nice. It's really sad for us to have lost both of them recently.
Absolutely. And, it was only months apart too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, it's really very, really heartbreaking for us because all these people all became, you know, it's kind of like a big family. So.
Sure.
Well, sure. When you're working with four movies with one actor or three movies with this actor, six with that actor. I mean, Bert was in all of them up to Balboa. I mean, so, you know, it does become, I mean, they all get together and do it again. It's got to be hard for them to, I mean, I'm sure you probably saw it. Sly went on social media after Carl Weathers died and he was visibly choked up. And it's tough. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, we feel that as fans and we don't even know them.
Right.
They were having a hard time finding that an actor to play that part. And I remember my father told me that they couldn't find the right guy to play Apollo Creed. And they were doing a casting session one day and Carr walked in there. And apparently he just had a couple of minutes. He had to catch a flight back to the Bay Area. And they wouldn't let him leave. They said, no, you're not going. You know, and you know, because finally, I think they felt the minute they saw him and the minute he was reading, they found their guy.
When you were talking about the popularity of, you know, Rocky, whether age 30 or 60, were you on set on Balboa when they were at the Italian market?
I was on set every day.
Okay. So there's truth in that where they weren't yelling Sly. They were they're yelling Rocky.
Listen, I'm telling you, it's amazing being with Sly in Philadelphia. I remember we would fly in for to do this is before we were shooting the movie, just to do some location scouting.
Okay.
We would fly in and we would walk through, you know, these neighborhoods in Philadelphia. We probably should have had more security with us. no, really. And people do not yell, "Hey, Sly," in Philadelphia. When they see him, that's exactly right. They yell, "Rocky, Rocky, it's right. Hey, Rocky's here," you know? And people, "Rocky's here?" You know, it's they relate to him completely. I mean, at least the people on, so many of the people on the street. And there were times where, you know, all of a sudden we'd have, you know, 10 people, then 20 people, then 50 people surrounding us.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of incredible how relaxed Sly was about it.
Well, it is crazy. It is crazy.
With them. Yep. I was a little, I was like, wait, this is not, this may not be good. I mean, we're in some terrible neighborhoods, Kensington in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all of a sudden we're surrounded by 50 people, you know, at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
But they love him and he loves them. And so,
yep.
Cause I had read it at the Italian market during that filming that you guys had to like move that along expeditiously because it was getting out of control.
They come from every nook and cranny to see Rocky. And you know,
Tony, we would have been there.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible. The connection that this character and that city have is it's something totally unique.
Agreed. And you know, the funny part about that, what you just said, is that I don't think it would have worked with any other city. And I'm not from Philadelphia. I'm originally from New York City. I don't think it would have worked in New York City. I don't think it would have worked in Chicago, Boston. For some reason, the city is much of a character of that film as Rocky or Adrian or anybody else.
You know, I think one of the reasons they shot the original film there, I don't remember this exactly, but I think it had something to do with the fact that there wasn't a union there, or there weren't many union members there.
Okay.
And shooting the film on such a low budget would have been impossible working completely union. And that they, like, you could never have done it in New York, that was such a union town.
Right.
But I don't know the exact story behind it, but I believe it had something to do with the fact that the union, the film union there, IATSE, was not quite as strong, and they could get away with a lot of stuff that they maybe wouldn't have otherwise, if I'm not mistaken.
Sounds about right, because I remember hearing stories about them jumping out of vans and filming a scene in 25 minutes and jumping back in a van and nobody's around and so yeah, that might have been
shot on the fly. John Avildsen, you know, what can you say about him? I mean, he was, what a brilliant man he was.
Oh, Lord.
And as Robert told you, he almost did the film that Robert and I were working on together.
Yeah.
And it's really unfortunate that he didn't, although we ended up with a wonderful director, but, and so we were lucky, but the plan was to do it with John.
Yeah, that's how this whole started, actually, with our introduction to you. He said, you know, he had yourself and he had John, the director, and Bert was going to be in the film. And, my Lord, I mean, it's got success written all over it right there. So,
well, it was Bert. It was Bert that actually, I mean, I don't remember exactly how Robert presented it on the podcast. And I'm not sure it was exactly the way I remember it. My recollection is that Bert introduced me to Robert and gave me Robert's script and told me to read it. That's my recollection that Bert was the connection between us.
And again, well-written characters you care about, characters you want to see succeed.
Robert and I are both big Yankee fans. So that was also part of our bonding process. So.
Okay.
I still like you guys anyway. I'm a Mets fan though, but that's all right.
You're what?
I'm a Mets fan.
Well, we won't go there. that's a different podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Trust me, growing up was rough. Majority of my neighborhood was Yankee fans.
My father grew up in the Bronx. Interestingly enough, near Gun Hill Road, but he was not a Yankee fan. He was a Dodger fan.
Oh, okay.
And the reason he was a Dodger fan, typically. And I think this says a lot about why Rocky got made, is that he loved underdogs.
There you go.
Yeah. The Dodgers were always underdogs, and they were always the bums.
That's funny that you say that, because the reason why we're Mets fans, my father and I, because my grandfather followed the Dodgers.
Right.
And when they left New York and went to L.A., he was not going to follow the Yankees.
Right.
So I'm not following the Yankees. And then when the Mets came in town, he started following the Mets. And the same thing. He's like, well, it takes more courage and more guts to follow a team like this.
Yeah, I always admire Cubs fans, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure I'm that much of a masochist, but
yeah. You couldn't be. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. That's but, so funny.
But that was, yeah, I mean, I think that that was, again, part of, at least for my father, his attraction to Rocky, that it was about an underdog.
Yeah.
And that was part of his character. He would always root, if you were watching a sporting event with him, he would always root for the team that was expected to lose.
Right, right.
Yeah, always. That was
you know what they say. Everybody loves an underdog. You know,
absolutely.
They say everybody loves an underdog.
Yeah, that was like really his nature. Yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah.
In fact, I have here. Speaking of, here, let me get it for you. This belonged to my father, and this, and of course, it's funny that he would have purchased this. This is an autographed copy of picture of the shot heard around the world.
Oh my God.
You see Jackie Robinson here.
Yeah.
Bobby Thompson at home plate. So it's funny that my father would buy a picture of one of the worst moments in Dodger history and put it on his wall.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So
that's
great. And it's autographed by Ralph Branca and Bobby Thompson.
Oh, both of them. Wow.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, so
very nice.
Anyway. Nice piece of baseball memorabilia right there.
Exactly.
Well, Bill, we couldn't be happier than having
you. How many of your questions did you get through? I think two.
One.
No, I actually think we hit, you know what? When you guys come on and you start talking like you're doing, you wind up hitting our questions without us even asking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it actually works out. Yeah. I mean, because you answer that question. I talked to you about growing up around the Rocky business, the PA on Raging Bull. Actually, there's only one question you didn't touch base on, if you wouldn't mind. I wrote, how do you differentiate from producing a movie that you'd like versus you think the audience would like? I mean, is there a difference, or do you just say, I'm going to produce a movie that I know I'm going to love, and if the audience likes it, that's great, or do you intentionally do things because you know the audience will like it?
I think the only way to live is to follow your heart.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when I was in film school, I went to first NYU film school and then to the American Film Institute. Oh, and wow. I remember, I don't remember who it was, but we'd have a lot of wonderful directors that would come by AFI. And I remember one of them said something that really stuck with me. And he said, paint the picture and then worry about selling it.
There you go.
And, you know, I think different people do things different ways. But I think that if you can't trust your gut, and you, when it comes to creative things, I mean, again, I go back to Sly, Sly has this instinctual understanding of what people will respond to.
Mm-hmm.
I will always trust him above everything when it comes to these kind of things. He just knows. But, you know, you also have to know what you think and what you believe and what feels like is a movie that you would want to see.
Right.
It doesn't always turn out the way you want it to, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Movies have so many moving parts, and they all have to move correctly for the movie to come out like a Rocky, for example. Mm-hmm. And so often that doesn't happen. So many films that don't turn out well started off with very good intentions. And really, the people wanted the movies. Obviously, they wanted them to be great movies.
Right.
But certain things happen through the process of writing them or shooting them or editing them where it might have just kind of gone somewhat off course.
A different way. Right, right.
Occasionally,
no, that makes sense.
Occasionally everything goes well. But no, I personally am not making it just because I want the audience to enjoy it. I want to make something that I feel is going to be a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that what interests me and what, you know, that the audience will also respond to. Who else are you going to follow?
Right.
You know, so that's my response to the question.
Rick, did you have any question that he didn't answer?
I think I had one real quick one was, do you have any memorabilia from the original Rocky movie or something from your dad that you have held up? Maybe his.
I have stuff. I'm not sure I have it here.
Oh, no,
a lot of look. I don't know where it went, but when I was a kid, I don't know if you remember. There's a poster in Rocky One of Apollo Creed standing there.
Yes.
It says Bicentennial. It's in the movie. And oh, I don't know how I ended up with it, but I had it when I was a kid in New York. Wow. I don't know where it is.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know where that is, that poster. But obviously, I've got all the posters. I've got a ton of buttons and things like that. Here I have, let's see, here's a Rocky IV cup.
Okay.
Oh, awesome.
You know,
that's great.
That, that they had made. I've got my, one of the things I like the most, I don't have it here, but is my crew gift from Raging Bull. We got these, we've got these beautiful little sterling silver boxing gloves.
Oh my God.
And very small, like about that big, sterling silver. And on one of it, it would say to your name. And then the other on the other one, it said, thanks, Bob and Marty. And I still have that.
That's great.
Somewhere. And that's one of the things that I'm most proud to have and most happy to have, let's say. I got a ton of buttons. I started, for example, I think both on Creed 1 and Creed 2, I think when we were shooting Creed 2, I gave Ryan a Rocky 2 button.
No kidding.
They had all these buttons. Yeah, these little,
very nice. The contender and one, champion.
Yeah, and they're original, which are these little buttons from the movie. So I gave Ryan a Creed 2 button, and I think I gave Stephen Caple a Creed 4 button. So I have a bunch of these buttons from the original Rocky movies that they would have made for each movie.
I got to tell you, introduction from
Let's Creed. See, here is my, I was wearing this morning. Here's my Creed, I don't know if you can see it, my Creed crew jacket.
Oh, yeah.
One. You know, there's a, I have an amazing jacket, very 70s or 80s, I guess, from Rocky IV. It was kind of one of those silk bomber jackets.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And on the back, it's got a big patch that's it's got the Creed IV logo in it of the US and the Russian flag.
Okay. Oh,
awesome. So I got one of those somewhere lying around in some closet somewhere. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff lying around.
Very that's, cool.
That's so awesome. Yeah, yeah. I was saying under my breath that the and the on Creed, the original opening when it comes into what was his name and it goes to that music and, you know, that's just like, it just hits you. It's like, bam.
Yeah.
Love it.
I remember, I mean, the first time we saw that with the music was in the studio when we were recording the music. And man, when you saw that with the music, you were like, wow.
Yeah.
that is going to really hit home with the audience.
It resonates for sure.
Yeah. Impact. Definitely.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun to see that for the first time. Yeah.
Very cool.
I mean, we could talk forever, Tony.
I know, really. That's why I said, Bill, this is an audio tape in the old days where we're going to run out of time. So
I know.
We have to stop it eventually.
I know, but
we couldn't thank you enough for coming on.
Well, maybe we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. I mean, we would be loving to hear.
You know, we might be enjoying it, but the audience might be bored out of their minds at this point.
Well, Rick and I are.
We're painting the picture.
That's why we do this. We're not making millions.
Yeah.
The good thing is, they can just turn it off. So,
exactly.
What did you say about painting the picture, right?
That's right.
That's right. Yep. Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
No, really. We thank you so much. And we would love to have you on again. We love hearing the Rocky stories and the old days or Creed stories or future stories. So,
it's been a lot of fun.
Would you come back?
A lot of fun. I watched some of your podcasts. I didn't. I'll be honest with you. I didn't know that it existed until Robert told me.
Understood. No,
I do no social media. None of, you know, I was unaware of it. So I did put on some of the podcasts and looked at them before. And I just think it's so wonderful that this podcast exists. I was pleasantly surprised. So happy to know that it does exist. So happy to know that there are people out there who are so interested in these movies and all the other things around these movies that you guys talk about. And it's really been wonderful sitting with the two of you, and I'm really honored that you asked me to come on. So thank you.
Well, formulate all your thoughts, because we're going to have you back on so you can tell more stories.
Yeah,
sounds exactly. good. Sounds
Thanks
good.
Thanks again, Bill. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
All right, guys. A real pleasure. Real pleasure talking to you.
Take care. We'll see you. Well, see, now that was that was worth the wait, wasn't it?
Oh, my God, Tony. That's like freaking...
Wow. I was looking forward to that so much, and I'm so glad he had as much fun as we did. What a pleasure to talk to. My goodness. What a pleasure.
Love the stories. Keep them coming.
I know. And he's like, can I tell another Rocky story? I mean, it's like, what do you mean? Absolutely. Please.
Man, let me go grab a pillow and a blanket. Talk away.
That's what I was like. There's no time limit here. This thing will just keep recording.
Let's go. So, this is one of this is our longest one to date.
It is. I know it is.
And that's okay.
And I would have kept going. So,
I didn't want to keep him all night, but at the same time, like I said, let's have him back.
So absolutely. Can
more,
absolutely. So, thank you again, everybody, for watching. We appreciate all the support. This one's a good one. So, if you miss it, go back and watch it. But otherwise, we will see everybody next week.
You got it.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you. Yep.